with Manning. Okay, so we are motivating the ADS-CFT correspondence. And for that, we need to understand a little bit of string theory. But it's mostly cartoons. And so we basically do understand string theory now. We know that there are two kinds of strings. You can have open strings, or you can have closed strings. It's approximately true that the closed string is something like open string square. So you have like more modes here in the closed case, and that's why the closed strings actually they carry this, you know, objects with two indices and stuff like that. So in particular, they carry the graviton, so the oscillations of the string can be associated with the existence of the graviton. So here for the open strings, you have the standard electromagnetism or vector fields over here. So now I also tried to discuss that string theory is actually very restricted. There is only one dimension full parameter in the theory, which is this length of the string. Okay, so that's the only dimension full parameter there is. I also told you that the strings actually can interact, and then there's the corresponding interaction constant GS, which is dimensionless. However, what this GS really is something like an expectation value of the dilaton. And so it's not really a new parameter which you are sort of introducing into the theory. So really, you can think about, well, for our purposes, our string theory is defined by two things, by LS and GS. Dimension full parameter of the, with the dimensions of length, and dimensionless parameter GS. But in fact, this guy is not really an independent parameter. All right, but that's not everything about the string theory. You also have some extended objects, and one of the extended objects could be D-brains. And so D-brains are simply walls where your open strings can end. And so the fluctuations of the string, they pull on the wall, and they can do some fluctuations of the D-brain and stuff like that. So what you do is that basically, yes?
I'm not sure I fully understand how we kind of conceptualize the association between the field and the string, right? Like, so like in QFT, you know, you've got particles as excitations of the field, but the strings, what's that? Like, it doesn't pervade space-time, does it? It's not an excitation of, like, the field. It's like,
it's an excitation of the string. So.
But the string's not, like, extended in space-time. The string is just, like, a small mm-hmm. thing, and then the excitation is field or what happened?
Okay, very good. So, let's not go into that question. It's a complicated question. But in fact, you can have many strings, right? And you can have string field theory, right? And so it's what you're asking basically is the subject of string field theory, which has nothing to do with this course. But yes, you can do the field theory of strings. but you know, each individual string gives you, you know, one particle. It gives you one graviton. It gives you one photon, it gives you something, right?
Would that be an excitation of the field or no?
It's a characteristic mode vibration of the string.
Yeah, but then so does the string have to exist before you can excite it?
What do you mean? So, of course, it exists.
But like, because we think of particles as like popping in and out of space time, right?
Yeah.
Excitation. They can come in, mm-hmm. but then the string, does it have to exist before you can get the excitation with, like, you know, the specific mode? Or does it have to exist independently?
It's a good question. I don't know how to answer that. So maybe let's discuss in the tutorial.
Okay.
Is that okay? Yeah. Thanks. Okay, let me go back here. So we have Dirichlet brains, we have the x-mu directions, and we split them into the directions which are perpendicular to the brain and those which are parallel to the brain. And so those which are parallel, it's my endpoint of the string is actually free to move in the brain. And so these xa directions, well, the endpoint looks like a point particle on the brain which can move in these xa directions. But then there's these xi directions where the brain is fixed. And so the particle cannot leave the brain in these xi directions. And so if you have a p-brain, then you have p plus 1 directions where you have these Neumann directions. And the rest, 10 minus that, is the other directions over here. You can also do the pullback of your excitations of your string. So for example, a pullback of a mu, and you can pull it back onto what happens on the brain, and that would be a vector field on the brain, or you can pull it back to these directions, and then you have scalar fields on the brain. Okay. So now the motion of a single d-brain is governed by this, you know, generalization of the Nambu-Goto action, where you basically say, well, my d-brain can propagate in curve space, and it can propagate in some non-trivial background b mu nu, and there's some non-trivial background coming from the open string FAB and stuff like that. And so then you get this beautiful square root action due to Dirac, Born, and Infeld. Okay? And so again, you have some tension of this d-brain, and the tension, because this guy has dimensions of p plus 1, length to p plus 1, then in order to get dimensionless quantity, this tension more generally is the length of the string to power p plus 1. Okay? So now, let's imagine the case. So now, consider that your brain moves in Minkowski. And for simplicity, that b is equal to 0, and that phi is equal to constant. So e to the phi equals to gs is equal to constant. So we are switching off this term here. We are just leaving the metric term. But now it's due to Minkowski. And you can use, OK, so first of all, if e to the phi is a constant, you can take it out of the integral. And so what you will be effectively doing is that you are dividing t by gs. And that's something which is like an effective tension of the string. Okay, so then you would have mu p, which is tp divided by gs, is something like effective tension. Okay. And second, you can use a beautiful formula, which you use many times, how to calculate the determinant of, so you can write this determinant of g plus f as determinant of g times 1 and 1 plus f over g. And then you can use a beautiful formula for how to calculate the determinant. So determinant 1 plus m for small m is given by 1 minus 1 half trace of m squared plus other things. And if you do that, of course, what you will get out of this square root determinant is that you will get, so GAB of B is 0, gamma AB of G, where G is eta, it just gives you something like 1. And so you will get trace of F square. So you get basically Maxwell theory. So then in that case, as dBi, something like, so f square, f also carries with it 2 pi alpha prime. So it will be minus 2 pi alpha prime square. And then tp divided by gs. And the integral dp plus 1 xi fab plus dot, dot, dot. OK, so this is what you get from this action if you use this approximation. So basically, you are taking weak electromagnetic field. And it's been known from the 30s that, you know, this action gives you something like Maxwell in the weak field limit. So this is precisely what we are getting. So we are getting the Maxwell Lagrangian here with this thing standing here proportional to 1 over g Young-Mills square. OK, and so we are getting that. So remember, alpha prime was, OK, so alpha prime was proportional to 1 over ls square. Tp is, OK, so we have square of that. so ls to the 4. Okay, and then tp is proportional to tp is proportional to 1 over ls p plus 1. And then we have the gs. So from here, you get that the g Young males square is equal to, and there's some prefactor, which is not important, p minus 2. But what is important is the dependence on GS and on LS, and p minus 3. Okay, so from here, you're getting that somehow GS and possibly LS as well actually give you what the Maxwell coupling is, actually. Okay, questions?
I'm sorry, but why is p equals 0 when costing?
Sorry, so this is just our assumption. So let's just consider something simple, right? Let's switch off b, why not? Let's consider just, you know, D-brain moving in the Minkowski space, approximately Minkowski space. Because what we will be really doing is that we will be sort of taking, you will see at the end of the lecture, we are taking two limits, sort of. We are taking one limit where the gravity is super, super weak, and it's really, you know, it will always be low energy limit, so it will be always, like, the massless excitations will be the only important. But we are taking two limits. One, where the gravity is super weak, which is this one here. Right, and so then what will be left out of the D-brain is basically like Young-Mills theory, okay? And then we'll be taking the other limit where gravity is super, super strong, and then this D-brain will in fact be described by something like a black hole, extreme black hole, and then that will be the other limit. So at this point, like, we are taking gravity to be weak, and we don't care about the B-field at this point, why not? All right, so now we have Carton 6, and that is about multiple brains. And so what can happen is that actually you have more than one brain. And so let's plot one brain like this, another brain like that, another brain like that. Okay, and so far we have been just discussing a situation where we had like one string which ended on this brain and extended somewhere. But of course what can happen is that this string can actually turn around and end at that same brain somewhere. So that's the other end of the string actually ends on the same brain. But what can also happen is that you start over here, but then you go to this brain, okay? Or you go to that brain. And stuff like that. So basically what you can do is that you can, you know, name your brains, right? And then let's name. And this is brain A, and this is brain B, and this is brain C, and stuff like that. And we already know that if we have, you know, the string which goes like this and ends on the same brain, that this corresponds to some kind of electromagnetism. So this thing here gives massless U1 AA field. Okay. What I haven't shown, and you have to believe me, is that if you have a string which, you know, starts somewhere and ends on another brain, then it is, what is important is the separation between the two brains. And the separation is proportional to the mass of the field. So you'll still have some kind of vector field, but now it will be massive because there's these things here. So now we have, so this string, for example, here will correspond to massive gauge field. with the mass, which is proportional to the distance between the two brains, with proportional to r divided by 2 pi alpha prime, where r is the distance between the two brains. Okay. So actually, you know, by putting more of these brains, you can get both massless fields and you can have massive fields. Okay. But what is also nice is that in some sense you carry the information. You should somehow note that, you know, this string starts at on the brain A, and that one finishes on the brain B. It will be definitely different situation than A and C and whatever, right? So what is actually happening is that you are adding one more piece of information, one more index to your field, okay? And so in fact, so for more brains, more D brains, means that we have extra index telling you where the string starts and where it ends. And so in fact, what you have is not only your AA field, but this AA field will carry extra index A and B, where it starts and where it ends. And so this is precisely where the Young-Mills theory actually, so this is a non-abelian okay, so this is how you can nicely geometrize the rise of non-abelian gauge theories. Yes?
What happened to the very first string you drew with the ends not, is seemingly not attached to anything? Is that possible?
Like, it's possible, yeah.
And so. What is it?
Oh, that's okay. It's not possible. it is possible. It is possible, but let's not discuss it here, right? It's not important for us, okay? So. good question. Okay,
but close string.
So closed strings, they don't care about these D brains, right? So the closed string, in principle, of course, you know what can happen is that the closed string can split and become an open string and stuff like that due to the GS coupling and these things. But let's not assume that it splits; it just goes through the D brain, doesn't care about it, right? And similarly, you can have strings which, you know, are fixed. On one end, they have these Dirichlet conditions, and then they have other conditions on the other end, so they can be completely free and you know, free to move. But they are not interesting for this story, right? Okay. Thanks for these questions. Good questions. Okay. So you know, it's really, you sort of geometrized, you know, this A and B index by saying, well, these things actually can end on different brains. And so why is this very interesting? Is that what you can do is that, of course, you can take these, you know, let's say n of these brains, and you can stack them all together. Okay, it's like my sheet of paper here. So I stack all the brains here, all the sheets, in one position. If that is the case, then the distance between them is zero. And you are giving rise to a zero mass non-abelian gauge theory. Okay, so this is how super Young-Mills actually arises. In string theory. So specifically, consider NC. So C stands for color, so it will be like number of colors in Young-Mills theory. NC, number of coalescent okay, and then we specify the P. We will want to have D3 brains, so 3 plus 1 dimensional brains, okay? So coalescent D3 brains, okay, and so and then in type 2B string theory, string theory. And so then this gives rise to, okay, so now then there's a different n, n equal to 4, that just stands for number of supercharges. It's not important for us. It's simply something that is supersymmetric. It will have the same number of degrees of freedom in fermions, the same number of degrees of freedom in bosons, and there are some supercharges, and there's 4 of them here. Okay. U and C, super Young-Mills theory. And because our D brains are 3 plus 1 dimensions, so we can think about that this super Young-Mills theory lives on this D brain, and so in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Okay. Concerns you.
What is a type 2 penis?
Okay, so I didn't explain that really. So you have a couple of different consistent string theories, depending on which kind of boundary conditions you have and stuff like that. We have type 1, type 2, 2a, 2b, and stuff like that. So this is one specific choice you are making of string theory. Okay? Yes?
I'm really confused about this massive field fields. Like, when we think about like massive fields in like GFD, we always talk about like some kind of attraction in case. I don't understand the correspondence.
Okay, I didn't explain this. So it's not important for us. We'll always be massless. Okay? So let's not go there.
Why does it get massive?
Yeah, I would have to, yeah. I don't know. I will have to look it up, why this is really massive, okay? But the statement is, it is, right? So what you are really interested in is in the brains which really are zero separated. We will be later looking at, okay, maybe I'll look it up, because we will later look at, the Wilson loops and stuff like that, and we will be studying quarks, and the quark is something which actually is, super massive. And so we'll be looking at, putting one brain at infinity and one brain here. And so then we will need some non-trivial mass. Okay, so I'll look it up how this arises if you want.
This is the only way that we give mass to field theories in a string theory? To fields in a string theory?
Well, it's a way. I don't know if it's the only way. I don't know.
I think that the way they get mass, because you have a spontaneous breaking out in the because you can move in the brains.
That makes sense, yeah.
But if you have some brains in one point and brains in another point, What you are doing is breaking that.
You're breaking that, yeah.
Smaller.
I should have, yeah.
And the mass is related to the length.
Thank you. Very good.
There's an easier picture it could have, which is just that your expectations of the string, right? There's really about conditions on both ends. And the smallest amount of energy you can have is the one equivalent to stretching the string by something. Right? And that rest energy is the mass. So the mass is proportional to the mass squared, proportional to the tension times the separation. Because that's the energy of a string of tension.
But then how does that?
Well, because that's just not, like, you could imagine that distance, like, there's another way, like, one way is to impose by fiat that there is separation. Another one is to set that separation by the expectation value of the scalar field that you produce upstairs. Okay. The scalar field acquiring expectation value means there's a separation between the brains, and that's where symmetry comes in. But if you have a separation set up at the beginning of the problem, it's really just stretching the string by some non-theory.
Thanks. Very good. So just to give you an idea what kind of beast we are talking about here. So this is the Lagrangian for our super young males. And yeah, so you have some scalar fields. You have some vector fields. You have fermions, which I'm not writing here. But if you look at the formula which you derive for the Young-Mills coupling over here, you derive that it's GS LS to P minus 3. But now we are choosing the D3 brain, so P is equal to 3, and so the Young-Mills coupling is just given by the GS over here. Okay, so that's important for us.
So we have the vector fields that are restricted on the onto the d-brains over there, and you introduced the gauge indices by saying we need to keep track of the d-brains.
Yes.
How do we know that they form the group UN?
Again, I'm not showing it. Just they do.
Conceptually, even from the point of view of like as just numbers that keep track of the d-brains.
So it gives you the well, I don't know conceptually, but it gives you the right number of indices, right? So how, if you have n d-brains, you have something like n square possibilities of n things like that. So that's maybe one very simple way that it could be so. Yeah.
So the gauge group acts by switching the endpoint, like switching the brain at the end, string end zone. Element of the gauge group might act on like a string and then move the endpoint from one brain to another. Because you're
using permutations. Well. Yeah. So these strings are oriented. So they you know start here, they end there, and so that's what's specified. And if you had a string the other way, it would be different thing, right? Okay, very good. So that's one picture. Okay, so that's the picture where your gravity is really you know very weak. It's you live in Minkowski space, and it's a picture of these you know where you imagine that the deep brains are something like object where the string can end. Okay, and but then you have the other picture, which is the massive picture, where you say well these deep brains are actually very massive objects. They are something like black holes, black brains, and they must be solutions because they are you know, massive and sort of classical. So they are sort of solutions of the classical supergravity corresponding to this string theory. Okay, so alternatively, the three brains can be viewed as extremal, as black hole solutions in 2B supergravity. So this is when they are actually very, very massive and when gravity is important. And so remember, I did write this supergravity action of type 2b, and it had so many fields in it, right? And so it had the axion, it had the, I don't know, 3-form, 1-form, 5-form, and stuff like that. But what people again, you know, look at is the simplest truncation of this 2b supergravity, and then they say, well, let's assume that that only some fields actually are switched on and all the other fields are zero. And you know, one truncation where this is consistent and you know the one field doesn't source the other fields which we said were zero, so that wouldn't be consistent. But if you say, you know, switch off such fields which are not sourced by the other fields, so then it's fine. So assume only that G mu nu and F5 are non-trivial, and that phi is equal to constant are the non-trivial fields. Okay, so you can do such a truncation, and it's all consistent. And in that case, your only Einstein equations, which you have to solve, are that R mu nu is given by this phi form. It's 1/96 F alpha beta gamma delta kappa F. Haha, that will not work. Mu, nu, beta, gamma, delta, kappa, something like that. And this phi form, I just said that, but again, it has to be self-dual. So which means that if you do Hodge duality in 10 dimensions, then this guy is self-dual. That's what you call self-dual. And notice that if you have the Bianchi identity, df5 is equal to 0, then of course d star of f5 will be a Maxwell equation, which is also zero. So actually, the Maxwell equation is satisfied because of the Bianchi identity is satisfied. Okay, df5 equal to zero implies Maxwell equations are also satisfied. Okay, and then people look at these things actually long before ADS-CFT, and they were constructing solutions of type 2B supergravity just for fun. And people like Gary Gibbons and, you know, people in Cambridge constructed lots of these solutions. So now the solution, which will be of importance to us, is this, you know, black brain solution, which you can think about is like near extremal. Right, it's not an Nordstrom solution. So you know that Weissner Nordstrom, as we did in the tutorial, has two parameters, Q and M. And then if you have Q equals to M, it's an extremal solution. Okay. And if you have Q approximately equal to M, it will be near extremal. Okay. And so let me write this solution here. That's not precisely what the D3 brain will be, but we shall see. So there's a horrible metric here, which lives in 10 dimensions. It's like this. It's characterized by a single function over here, h. But there's also a blackening factor here. And then it's dx square, dy square, dz square. And then plus h to 1/2 dr square over f plus r square d omega 5 square. So that's the metric. The metric has a sphere in it, and it has some flat directions. So you can really think about it like a flat sheet, and so x would be there, and y would be there, and z would be another direction here. But then there's, in addition to that, there's this sphere in 5 dimensions. And then, of course, this thing here has non-trivial f5, so the f5 is still here. And this is given by minus 4 L square. Think about it like electromagnetic field, but now with this higher rank, 8 square r to the 5, and then r0 square plus L square, 4, and then 1 plus Hodge-Tool, dt, dx, dy, dz, dr, 5, that's fine, where this metric function h is 1 plus l to the 4, r to the 4, and this function f0 is 1 minus r0 to the 4, r to the 4. Okay, so that's a solution. Okay, you can check it with Mathematica or Maple. This thing here will satisfy this, you know, Einstein equation in 10 dimensions with this phi form here. And the phi is constant. Okay, so that's a solution discovered long time before the ADS-CFT conjecture is. So now, this thing here, F0, is called blackening factor. And what it tells you is how much your black hole is not extremal. Okay? So basically, if you remember the form of the solution of the Weissner-Nordstrom solution which we discussed in the tutorial, we had, I think, H, which is something like 1 over m plus r or something like that. That's what we had in the tutorial, right, for the extremal Weissner-Nordstrom solution. So it's precisely this h here, but now you have r to the 4 because you are in more dimensions, you are not in 4 dimensions, and the black hole is now extended in these x, y, z directions. So that's why there's r to the 4 here. But it's the same thing as you've seen in for the extremal Weissner-Nordstrom solution. However, I have also included here the possibility of f0. So we also know from the tutorial that in these coordinates, the horizon of the Reisner Nordström solution is situated at r equal to 0. Okay, r equal to 0 is the extremal horizon. So and now in this case here, you see that something strange happens at r equal to r0, which is positive here. Okay, so actually in this case, we have two horizons. We have a horizon, so this guy has two horizons. Horizons, one at r equal to 0 when the h becomes, well, infinity, and the other one is at r equal to r0. Okay, so this is the outer horizon. This is the inner horizon, sort of the Reisner-Nordström solution. Okay. This one is the outer. So now what we will be interested in is not, well, we will need this solution later on as well when we discuss finite temperature, because you know that a non-extremal black hole has finite temperature. So when we will discuss finite temperature ADS-CFT, we will need precisely this solution over here. However, if you want to discuss zero temperature CFT, ADS-CFT, then you just say, well, I just want extremal black hole, okay? So now focus on extremal case, which is precisely what describes the D3 brain. And that has simply R0 equal to 0, okay? So that, if R0 is equal to 0, F, I call it F0, okay. So let's put F0 over there as well. So the F0 is just trivial, it's just 1. And the solution simplifies, and this is what would correspond to the D3 brain, okay? So in that case, we have F equal to 1, F0 equals to 1, and everything is encoded about your brain and in this H, okay?
David?
Yes?
For the solution, is the single D3 brain?
So this would be,
like, stacking or?
So this is a very, very good question. So we will treat it as a stack of NC brains, okay? But really here, in this limit, what we are saying is that the brain is super, super, super massive. It's like an object which gravitates and, you know, looks like a black hole. So really, you know, how many brains you have is really encoded in the mass of this object, sort of. And so we will assume that precisely this mass is composed, like that we have, you know, the tension of each brain times the number of brains gives us the mass, basically. So that's what we will assume, right? So we will treat this as a number of brains. Yes?
Are we thinking of the brains to be enclosed in the event horizon or outside the event? Like, how are they related in space? Like, where the brains are located and where the horizon is?
I don't know. So when you think about the extreme horizon and Nordström solution, right? What would you say, right? So so you would say there's some horizon, and there's this neck of the deep throat of the where, you know, which is outside of the black hole, right? But where the mass of the horizon and Nordström is located, right? It's somewhere underneath the horizon.
Can I ask something else?
Yes.
And we are only using the DBI action here, right? Not like string configuration that we consider, or is it just like the brains, the action on the brains to drive this part?
So this is like two different pictures you can look at the D brains. One is this, you know, open string picture, which is, you know, when the gravity is super weak, and then you have this, you know, super gravity picture, which is like a classical picture, if you want. When you consider the brain to be super, super massive, super, super gravitating, so that actually, you know, it changes the space-time and stuff.
Two separate limits.
Okay. So now, let's see what this L to the 4. So we know in Reisner Nordström case is that this H was 1 plus M over R. So this L to the 4 has to play the role. So in other words, M over R is like a gravitational potential, right? So we have a one plus gravitational potential. So here, the H is also one plus gravitational potential. So let's just look at, so there's a couple of ways how you can justify this important relation, which I'll do, but let's consider just phi is the gravitational potential. And we know that phi goes like m over r in four dimensions for a point-like source, right? So now the statement is that if you have an extended object, and if you are in d dimensions, then this will go like g 10. Well, for us, 10 dimensions, m total divided by r d minus p minus 3. Okay, so d is the number of dimensions, so 10, and p is the number of dimensions of the black brain. Okay, we can check this for Schwarzschild. So for Schwarzschild, d is 4, p is 0, it's a point-like source. So it's d minus 3, so it's r, just r to power 1, and so it works. So we just proved it, okay? So we just choosing d equal to 4 and p equal to 1 has 0, proves this relation. So, very good. So this guy here, if we are now in 10 dimensions and we have a d3 brain, so this will go like r to the 4. Okay, so this is g10 m total divided by r to the 4. So that's good. So that's recovering that h over there. But let's see. So last time I showed you, at least try to convince you that this g10 behaves like gs square ls to power 8. Okay, so that's what g10 was behaving like. Okay, so now you have m total, and then we say, yeah, let's this configuration, our gravitating configuration, actually corresponds to nc number of the three brains. Okay, so then m total will be nc times the true tension of the brain, and that gives us the total mass. Okay, so this is m total, and then divided by r to the 4. Okay, but mu 3 somewhere here, maybe you see mu 3 anywhere?
Effective tension.
It must be, yeah, it must be. So this mu 3, okay, so this is gs squared ls to the 8 divided by r to the 4, and then we have nc, but effective tension was like t3, which goes like 1 over ls to power 4, that's t3. But it's also divided by GS, okay? So this is what is that. So now we should find that this thing here goes like, so there's only one GS left, and then there is LS to power 4, and then there is NC divided by r to the 4, okay? Now this thing here, we could just define to be lambda, the Toft coupling, and you know, this is justified. But you know that the Toft coupling, if you've seen it in field theory already, is given by G. Young-Mills square times n of a number of colors. But it's precisely that. So we have Gs here. G. Young-Mills square is Gs. So this is like G. Young-Mills square times the number of colors here, right? So it's the same lambda as you've seen in the field theory. Okay, so there's so this is something like lambda times ls to the 4 r to the 4, okay? And now you see that, you know, so this is the strength of the gravitational potential for this P brain or D3 brain in D dimensions, in 10 dimensions. Okay? And so you see that if you have two limits, right? So one limit is when lambda is much, much more than one. Well, if that happens, then the phi will be zero, and we have almost Minkowski. You have Minkowski. On the other hand, if lambda is much, much bigger than one, then this potential will be huge, and we will possibly have black hole. We have strong gravity and whatever, right? So this is the strong gravity regime. So when we have Minkowski and almost flat space, right? So then, you know, it's this regime which should be important. So it will be the open string regime, which we discuss over here. So this thing here will be like the open string picture of the D brain, where we really think about the Young-Mills theory and all these things. And in this case, we'll talk a strong gravity picture is this black hole picture. Okay, this is the black hole picture. This is the closed string picture. We know that gravitons correspond to closed strings. So closed string picture, the black hole picture. Okay. By the way, what we have also shown by this very simple calculation is that, well, our h is 1 plus l to the 4 divided by r to the 4, right? But that must be related to the Newtonian potential phi, or whatever, to the gravitational potential phi. So if we have h, it's 1 plus l to the 4 divided by r to the 4, it must be 1 plus phi, and we show that this is something like 1 plus lambda ls to the 4 divided by r to the 4. So what you conclude is that l to the 4 divided by ls to the 4 is something like lambda. Okay. And we also use this thing here, that lambda is g Young-Mills square and c, which is also proportional to GS and C. Okay, so these are the two relations which have to be true. Very good. So now we have the D3 brain. It's simply the extremal black hole solution. We know that the parameter of this solution, the L, has to be somehow related to the other picture. So in one picture here, we have the Young-Mills theory living on the brain. The Young-Mills theory is characterized by the Toft coupling, lambda, and by the number of colors, NC. Okay, so we have two parameters here. We have NC here, and we have the lambda, which characterize your Young-Mills theory on this picture. On the other hand, in this black hole picture, we have parameters which characterize the string or whatever. So we have the string length here, and we have the string coupling constant. So on this picture, we have LS, and we have GS. Okay, and these two relations, which are over here, precisely give you how to translate these parameters of the Young-Mills to the parameters of the black hole or of the string theory. Okay. But let's go one step further and let's say, okay, very good. So we have this, D3 brain, and the D3 brain is extremal solution, right? And so we know from your tutorial that if you have extremal black hole solution and you want to zoom on the horizon, you want to go close to the horizon, you go deep in the throat of the extremal black hole. Okay, so now near, this is not a good blackboard. Let me delete that one. Okay, so if you have near horizon region close to this D3 brain, then we can do exactly the same calculation as you have done in your tutorial for the extremal Reisner and Nordstrom solution. You just go close to the horizon, which is located at r equal to 0. So you take the limit r goes to infinity. R goes to 0, yeah. R goes to limit 0 limit. And what you find out of this solution, okay, so consider near horizon limit of D3 brain, and very good. So what we are doing is that we are sending R goes to 0. If you are sending R goes to 0, then H goes like L to the 4 divided by R to the 4. L to the 4 divided by R to the 4. Now, if you look at your solution for the metric, so we have the ds10 square, then goes like, and they say 1 over square root of h, right? If you look at that metric there, it's 1 over square root of h, the first thing. So this goes like r square over l square. And then we set f0 equal to 1, right? So we consider the extremal case, so f0 is equal to 1. So what you really have in that first bracket is minus dt square plus dx square plus dy square plus dz square, right? Everybody can see that over there, right? So you can write this as eta mu nu dx mu dx nu, where this thing here is just minus dt square plus dx square plus dy square plus dz square. Okay, that's the first part. And then you have the other part over there. So now it's h to 1/2. So that will go like l square over r square. And then you have dr square. And then you have l square over r square d omega 5. Square. Okay. So that's what you get by limit of that geometry over there. Of course, r square cancels here. So you can delete it like that. And then finally, if you like, so this is already, you see there is some kind of sphere with the radius L, right, standing here. And then this thing here will be just ADS5 with the same radius L. Okay, but just to see it, if you like this form of ADS5, it's fine. The other form is that you just do exactly what you did in the tutorial. You just do a substitution. Z is L squared over R. And then what you will find that this metric here precisely writes as ds10 square equals to L square over Z square eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. And then this thing here will add the dz square term. So it's plus dz square. And then plus l square d omega 5 square. Okay, so that's what the near horizon geometry is. This is evidently the sphere S5 of radius L. And this guy, as we will discuss in the next lecture, is precisely the ADS5 of radius L. So you just got that in the near horizon geometry, you have ADS5 cross S5. So this is AES 5 cross S5 geometry. And since I have still more 2 minutes, I want to give you the full AES CFT picture, so the conjecture. So that will result in carton number 7. So carton 7, which is the AES CFT conjecture. And so basically the statement is that you assume that the following two pictures are equivalent. So you have the open string picture, which is I have the stack of NC D3 brains. So we have D3 brains, NC number of D3 brains. Where the open strings can end, but because they are all situated in one, so really what you observe here is the 3 plus 1 dimensional n equal to 4 super young males with U and C. Okay, so that's what you have here. And of course, this picture will be only true when the gravity is negligible, right? So this is open string picture, and it's valid when lambda is much, much smaller than 1, when phi is 0, the gravitational potential is 0. So this picture is like that. And of course, you know, if you are far, far, far away from here, you can have other objects and whatever. You will have other excitations than super young males. You will have massive excitations as well. However, if you consider low energy, it's only the massless excitations which are dominant. So this is the picture when lambda is much, much smaller than 1. On the other hand, you have the closed string picture, which is valid for lambda much, much, much bigger than 1. In which case you have this black hole description, right? And so you have a picture of the black hole, which is extremal black hole. You have an infinite throat here. So this is a throat. Here in the throat, you have AdS5 cross S5 geometry. That's what we derived. Okay, and so now, well, most of these pictures are only true when you have low energy. So what does it mean that you have low energy in this picture? It means I have only massless excitations. What does it mean that you have low energy in this picture? It means that asymptotic observer at infinity sees low energies. Okay, so what does it mean? It means that if I am deep in the throat, I'm close to the horizon, right? I can have some things here, you know, weird things here in the horizon. But whatever the energy they have is I have to climb up the gravitational potential. This energy decays, and it's redshifted at infinity. So I can have very high energetic excitations here, but they will be seen as low energy over there, OK? So arbitrary high excitations here are still out. Okay, and so we have a conjecture. So the throat AdS5 is 5, where everything can happen. Because whatever happens, no matter how big energy these things have, the energy will be, you know, redshifted when you go. Everything can happen according to our theory. we are within the realms of type 2B string theory.
Okay.
So it means that whatever happens here should be equivalent to that. Maybe. Okay, so I'll give you the conjecture and then we can return back what it means next time. So we have a conjecture. Due to Maldacena, is it 97? And the conjecture is type 2B superstring on ADS 5 crosses 5 is dual to n equal to 4. Let's put SUNC just to confuse you. Super young males in d equal to 3 plus 1 dimensions. Okay? And so that's the ADS-CFT conjecture in its original form. And basically, it comes from comparing, you know, this picture here and that picture there. And let me stop here, and I will return back to this, what it means and why this may not be so obvious and why it's still a conjecture. OK, questions?
Astrophysically, most black holes are not charged. Is it true for Schwarzschild and Kerr black holes as well that deep in the throat we get ADS 5 plus?
So very similar. So if you have, if you have extremely rotating black holes, you still do get, I think it's very similar. Symmetry enhancement. And there's a throat as well and stuff like that. So it's very, very similar. However, nobody really claims. Let me stop there. So I don't claim that we live in ADS 5 crosses 5, right? I don't claim that. So I'm not saying that this duality has, you know, directly any astrophysical applications, right? But I will specify what I mean by this later. Okay, so this duality is very useful for some calculations, for understanding something, but I don't claim that we necessarily live in ADS 5 crosses 5. More questions?
Could you explain again how the ratio?
So it is just, you know. How is the redshift? Well, anyway, so you know, if you start with something which is highly energetic here, then as it climbs up, you know, it is redshifted, right? So you have to climb up the gravitational potential, and so you are losing energy. So that's why you allow here in this throat arbitrary high energy excitations, because they will still be low energy as seen from the observer who is outside here, right? So low energy. What low energy means here is for an observer who is outside, who is far away from there, and so you allow, you know, the full string theory here. It doesn't have to be just, you know, low energy approximation of the string theory. It can be like full.
How is it related to the convection?
So that's why you say here that, you know, on this ADS 5 S 5 there is the full superstring here. Okay, you are not saying it's a type 2B supergravity, which is low energy limit of the string theory and stuff like that. You're saying it's the full superstring living here. It's still low energy from the point of view of the observer sitting here, and that's why, you know, the conjecture is like that. Okay, but it's all sort of hand waving and anyway. Okay, I'll return back to this conjecture. More questions? Isn't this cool? Okay, great. I'll see you on Wednesday then.